Very soon, people will be gathering around a table, and the youngest in attendance will ask, "Why is this night different from all other nights?" And the Passover Seder will begin. Here to give us some historical perspective as well as some advice for those who would like to be good Passover dinner guests is Bruce Feiler. You may remember that he has literally walked through the five books of Moses and written seven best-selling books on his own, including Abraham and Where God Was Born. You can find his article, Who Invited This Guy, in the April issue of Gourmet magazine, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to the show. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Leonard. Always great to be with you.
How big a Seder will you be attending? Or will you be attending both nights?
I'll be attending both nights. I grew up, I feel obliged, since Jane Fonda has just staked claim to being a Georgian, to pointing out that I'm a fifth-generation Georgian from Savannah, and we had one Seder growing up. And in my family, Thanksgiving is the national holiday. But I married into a family from Boston, and the Rotenbergs, who I married into, Passover is their national holiday. And so that my in-laws host 35 people on one night and a different 35 people on the second night. And it's such a big deal in my in-laws' family that when my in-laws expanded their house a couple of years ago, they didn't do their bedroom or the kitchen, which of course is what most people do. They did their dining room so they could fit more people. But actually the first time I was ever with you was when we were talking about Walking the Bible, which is my book about retracing the five books of Moses you just mentioned. And I had just basically finished that journey before I went to this first Seder, and I sort of warned, I'm going to be the most insufferable Seder guest because I crossed the Red Sea or the likely Red Sea and climbed the likely Mount Sinai and tasted manna, and, you know, I'm going to be the guest from hell who was a Mr. Know-It-All. And so kind of the idea behind this piece in Gourmet was, hey, you know, why be the only insufferable guest? You too can be a Seder Know-It-All.
Well, isn't that part of what the whole ceremony is about, which is learning more? I was always encouraged to ask questions during the Seder. Usually my father didn't know the answers, but that was a whole other matter.
Well, that's, of course, one of the great traditions. Not only are the four questions, but kind of then there's the sons and the different children, and questioning is part of it. And actually, I just came, as it happened, 15 minutes ago from the Seder at my, as you may recall, I have twin daughters who were about to be four, and so they just had a Seder at their synagogue preschool that I was at this morning. And as you point out, the youngest person is supposed to do it, and you've got a room full of three-year-olds, and so everybody was asking these questions, and that is a highlight. I think the other thing that's interesting about it is that it changes over time. I've actually spent the last couple of years working on a book about Moses that's going to come out this fall, and the influence of Moses in America. And if you look over time, the kind of questions that people would ask, particularly at American Seders, would change. Okay, so back. Back in the 50s, there was lots of talk about civil rights. Today, there's lots of talk about Darfur at the Seder that I attend and many other Seders. And there were talks about Soviet Jewry and questions about that. And so one of the things that's great, I think, about the Seder is that the topic of conversation that comes up when it's sort of out of slavery into freedom, there's usually invariably something going on in the news that's very relevant to the theme that's been talked about for 2,000 years.
Now, I've seen a fair number of Haggadahs over the years, and they change as well. The wording of the translations seem to change to reflect what's going on in the world. But when was the Haggadah originally written, and how much has it evolved over the years?
Well, if you put the whole timing into perspective, so let's just start with when the events in the Seder would have taken place, right? So that would have been you would have had the earliest patriarchs. You mentioned Abraham would have been born 4,000 years ago, around 2000 BCE. So Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, then the Israelites go down 430 years. They're enslaved in Egypt. And then along comes Moses and leads the Israelites out of slavery into freedom. So the kind of best guess as to when that might have happened would have been, say, 12, 1300 BCE. So that's 3,300 years ago. There was a big change kind of going on in the region, and that's when there was this kind of tumult, when there was kind of a big transfer of power. Egypt was losing a lot of its power. Other powers were rising. So you have the events would have happened then. They weren't actually written down in the Hebrew Bible for another 700-800 years until the middle of the first millennium BCE. So at that point, they're not Jews. They're still Israelites. They're now being written down in the Hebrew Bible, but there's still no Judaism. A lot of the kind of basic building blocks of Judaism, as you know, in terms of synagogue or worshiping an invisible god or celebrating these holidays, didn't really begin until the exile in Babylon, which was the 6th century, and really Judaism then evolves over the next several hundred years. The Haggadah itself wasn't written down for another 600-800 years until the middle of the first millennium of the Common Era, right after the birth of Jesus. And at that point, Jews in general are more settled. So you take a question like, you know, why is this night different from all other nights? Well, one of the answers is on this night we recline. Well, what's kind of amusing about that is that when the Israelites would have crossed the Red Sea, they would have only reclined. I mean, there was no wood. There's no furniture. I mean, one of the interesting things about Genesis, there's no furniture ever mentioned because they were living in tents. They were eating on carpets. They were reclining all the time when they ate.
But isn't Haggadah, that the way a lot of people in the Middle East still eat? Bedouins eat in tents as well, and they usually have pillows, don't they?
Certainly Bedouins, and they have pillows, and there is general reclining, and there's mm-hmm. a kind of a general culture of, you know, one of the great things about visiting, say, the Sinai Desert today is the Bedouin are living not that different from the way they would have lived 3,000-4,000 years ago. They're still, you know, we have this idea that progress is kind of eternal. Everybody progresses at the same pace, but yet there is still a percentage of the population that's kind of living outside that kind of cult or maybe culture of progress that is still living in a traditional way, and you can get a great sense of how they would have lived if you go out into the desert. It's the number one piece of advice I get when people go to Israel. They say, what should I do in Israel? What should I do? And I was like, go into the desert, because you will understand the Bible more, I think, by stepping away from the civilized world, going into the desert. That's the great essence of what the biblical story is about.
So the Haggadah was first written before the diaspora?
Well, no, in the sense that the diaspora really begins, I think, technically, it would be during the Persian era. So you've got
I'm talking about when the Romans forced everybody to go elsewhere.
Yeah, well, first they go off to Persia and they begin to disperse. And I think myself of the diaspora as beginning, if you want to say in the Roman era, before the time of Jesus and before the birth of Christianity, one of the reasons that Christianity spread so quickly around the Mediterranean is because there were Jews living all over the Mediterranean who already knew the basic story. And so when you then added the addition of the Messiah, and the Messiah is now here, the Messiah, of course, being a Jewish concept, that Jesus is the Messiah, he has come, and Paul kind of spreading the story, it spread so lightning fast because there were Jews everywhere. So I would say in that sense it's after the diaspora, and therefore the idea of next year in Jerusalem, the end of the Seder, the admonition at the end, which they do say in Jerusalem, by the way, but already that idea of returning to the land. I mean, and Jesus, in fact, was on a Passover pilgrimage, which is one of the several times a year people tried to go to Jerusalem. He comes to Jerusalem at the time of the crucifixion because he was on a Passover pilgrimage going to the temple. That's when he overturns the table and the money changers and the whole birth of Jesus story, the crucifixion of Jesus, begins to unfold at Passover.
I've always been told that the Last Supper was a Seder.
Yes, and in fact, there is a room for anybody going to Israel. There is a room actually on the top of Mount Zion, which is in the Old City, but at the highest point in the Old City, closer to, say, the King David Hotel, for those familiar with the geography, much higher than where the temple is in the Temple Mount today, there is a room that sort of tradition says is the room where the Seder and the Last Supper were taking place.
My guest is Bruce Feiler, who's written an article for the April issue of Gourmet Magazine about the Seder called Who Invited This Guy? You are probably aware of his other books, including Walking the Bible, Abraham and Where God Was Born. So let's talk about some of the history that's included in the Haggadah. Had the Jews built the pyramids during their stay in Egypt?
This has got to be one of the great persistent myths of all time. I mean, it kind of began, about 1,500 years ago. I mean, even when Menachem Begin went to visit Anwar Sadat and they were standing overlooking the pyramids, Begin said, our forefathers, he had that deep voice, which I won't try to imitate, our forefathers built these, and kind of all the his aides came rushing forward, and he sort of pushed them away. If you go back to the chronology we were just talking about, I think it's pretty safe to say that the Exodus, the central story, going out of slavery, crossing the Red Sea, going into freedom, would have occurred, say, 12, 1300 BCE. That's, you can kind of piece together the timing. The big pyramid, the Great Pyramid, was built in 2600 BCE, which is a good 1400, 1500 years before the Israelites would have fled Egypt, though there's no evidence that story ever took place, but that's when I think the best guess is that happened. So it's basically as long from us to Constantinople as it was from the Israelites to the building of the Great Pyramid. So we didn't build Constantinople, and they didn't build the pyramids.
Before he headed the NRA, Charlton Heston parted the Red Sea in the movie The Ten Commandments. You mentioned earlier that there's some question as to what the Red Sea really is.
Just first a bit on Charlton Heston, because that's a big part of my book on Moses, actually, and I spent some time with DeMille's granddaughter. They actually used a tank on the back lot of Paramount Studios, and essentially what they did to split the Red Sea in the Ten Commandments, the 1956 film, was basically put all of these, and there were some stuntmen and some horses and all this kind of stuff in the bottom of this tank, and they dunked all, then they poured all the water in, and then when they showed it on the film, they did it backwards, because this was the 50s and they didn't have the special effects that they have now. There basically are five bodies of water that are candidates for what the Israelites would have crossed, and these are all basically in that joint, if you will, between Egypt and the Sinai. The Sinai being this kind of giant, empty isosceles triangle wedged between Africa and Asia. You've got the so going from north to south, you've got the Mediterranean. I mean, think of the Suez Canal going there now. So you've got the Mediterranean. You've got a marshy area just south of there, a group of lakes called the Bitter Lakes, a smaller lake called Timsa, and then the actual Red Sea itself. Now, the biblical term for this body of water is Yam Suf, which is literally translated as Sea of Reeds, not the Red Sea. That was a mistranslation that was put into place when the Greeks translated the Hebrew into the Septuagint, and it eventually made its way into the King James Bible in 1611. So the Suf, the reed in question, is papyrus, which is a freshwater reed, right? So that rules out the Mediterranean, the marsh, and the Red Sea, which are all salt water. So you've got the Bitter Lakes, and you've got this one lake, Timsa, and I've been on this lake a number of times, and there's kind of, you know, it's really where informed speculation centers on, because it's a shallow lake, and it's easy to imagine on a windy day the Israelites wading across.
Could you go into the background of the lamb shank, the bitter herbs, and the cheroses?
Well, you've got the basic idea is you've got the plagues are unfolding in the Hebrew Bible, right? Because Moses, he was raised in the biblical story in the house of the Pharaoh, and then suddenly he becomes kind of aware somehow that he is a descendant, he's a Hebrew, though the text doesn't really explain this. He then one day, he develops this affinity for the slaves, the Hebrew slaves who were building the store cities, and he murders an Egyptian, flees into the desert. He's in the desert for a long time, gets married, sees God in the burning bush. God says, okay, you're going to be the person who's going to liberate these enslaved people, because I hear their pain. That notion of hearing their pain is so central to the Bible, right? You yourselves were enslaved in Egypt, so you should be sensitive to other people who experience hardship. Moses goes back and says, famously, let my people go, and the Pharaoh says no. So then that basically the plagues begin to unfold.
Any evidence that there were such things? There probably were locusts.
Well, there's lots of, I mean, if you think about them, right, what's the center of Egyptian culture? It's the sun, right? The sun god.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore darkness would have been particularly frightening. So if you're a culture that's dependent on the water from the Nile, which of course would flood twice a year, the Nile silt was so valuable to the soil in Egypt that they could grow two crops in a single year. So when the Nile would flood, that would provide life. So the idea of the water turning to blood. So while we don't have specific evidence that the individual event took place, these are well-chosen plagues in terms of people who really understood Egyptian culture and what would have been most frightening to them. So, you know, the pharaoh resists, as you know, and then so we go through this whole escalation of what the various plagues are going to be, and so finally God sends, the text says, the kind of coup de grace, the final plague, which is the killing of the firstborn the firstborn sons. And so the Israelites, how would their firstborns be saved? And so there's this notion of sacrificing a lamb, taking the shank and spreading the blood on the doorposts to let the spirit know to pass over. There's the origin of the term Passover. Pass over this house, because inside are the Israelites.
Well, we have pretty much run out of time, so I can't ask you about manna. But just one more question before we go. We were talking about being a good Passover guest. Should people refrain from saying, I'm hungry, when do we eat?
Well, if you came to my house, which is a little bit different from my in-laws' house, the highlight of the meal, certainly my father checks and knows by heart and is just waiting for the right moment to say, turn to page 47, where it doesn't say Dayenu and it doesn't say next year in Jerusalem. It says the meal is served.
Mm-hmm. So he just rushes through.
Quicker
than the hills skipped like rams. Bruce Feiler, thank you so much for talking with us. People can find out a lot more about the Passover Seder in your article in Gourmet Magazine, the April issue. The article is called Who Invited This Guy? It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Great to be with you, Leonard, and I hope you get to attend a great Seder.